proposal would pay for a 4-year building and repair program with $600 million of oil settlement money. But Monday on Alaska Public Radio's monthly call...
3, 2, 1. Alaskans haven't heard much about the gas line in the last couple of years, but all that's about to change. In the last few weeks, Yukon Pacific President Jeff Lowenfeld has been taking his slide presentation on the road, trying to drum up support to get the gas line going.
We do have a market opportunity that is going to evaporate if we do not accelerate the pace at which this project is moving forward. There are a lot of studies for alternates. They don't work. There is a lot of posturing between ARCO Exxon and BP that are not in the state's best interest as a whole, and it is just simply time to put all of those posturings aside and move this project forward.
Lowenfeld says the major oil companies operating at Prudhoe Bay have conflicting interests when it comes to marketing the natural gas underneath the North Slope. Various ownership shares have complicated the equation, and Lowenfeld is trying to teach Alaskans a quick lesson in oil politics and economics. He says unless the legislature pushes the oil companies into making the gas available soon, other Asian projects will satisfy world demand and there won't be any pipeline. Alaska will lose some 10,000 construction jobs and between $400 and $800 million a year in royalty income.
We've said that the market window of 2005 is that the ARCO, Exxon, and BP have seemed to have identified is a bit too late. We'd like the legislature to confirm whether we are right or whether they're right, because if we're right, we need to be acting today.
Lowenfeld recently made his pitch to about 50 lawmakers and industry leaders. One of them, Frank DeLong, spent more than 20 years working for Exxon, last as manager for Southeast Asian operations. He says the pipeline's a risky project.
Most of the competing gas sources are at Oceanside, so you don't have to have a $15 billion investment just to bring it to the seashore. However, if they're willing to take that risk and not ask for a subsidy, I think we ought to give them the opportunity to take that risk.
DeLong says several other projects are closer to Japan and have better economics. For his money, DeLong says he would invest elsewhere. Oil company officials agree that under the current proposal, the project remains too expensive to compete, and billions of dollars must be shaved to make North Slope gas affordable to Pacific Rim nations. Lowenfeld counters that market timing and other factors help even out the balance, and as lawmakers in Juneau debate another round of royalty breaks for the oil industry, he wants them to extract a promise to make the gas available. North Pole Republican Gene Theriault says he expects that very subject will be raised when the legislature convenes in January. And while the lure of another mega project is enticing, he welcomes the debate between Yukon Pacific and the oil majors.
I realize that both of them are corporate entities that are spinning their side of the story. I don't really expect anything more or less, to tell you the truth. I guess I try and process all the information with a fairly jaundiced eye and look at the source.
In this case, the source offers a polished presentation. On the lighter side, Lowenfeld exercises a sharp wit as he mixes some old-time tent revival with public skepticism about the true intentions of the oil industry. At minimum, it's good entertainment, but Lowenfeld raises important questions regarding Alaska's future, and that's something Alaskans have a big stake in understanding. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
When people who depend on caribou, whale, geese, and other wildlife for subsistence hear about PCBs or about dioxin or mercury in the food chain, they're understandably concerned. If the animals that sustain life for them prove to be contaminated, subsistence hunters, their families, and communities may be at risk. Pollution is a problem, but in some ways, science and anxiety also stand between subsistence users and confidence that their age-old diet is still safe. North Slope Borough toxicologist Todd O'Hara says, among other things, communication between scientists and consumers needs to improve. Scientists, he says, need to speak what they know plainly.
It's like any discipline. Auto mechanics, even people who hunt marine mammals, have their own communications. And so our job is to sort of take our way of speaking and communicating and put that in a more general context that more people can understand without alarming people, because some of these key words like polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, really gets people's attention.
O'Hara says North Slope and other scientists have a good grasp on the contaminant levels of many animals people eat in the Arctic. They know a lot about bowhead and beluga whale, caribou, eider, and marine fish. Importantly, though, he says they don't know enough about the habits of people.
We don't know what people consume, and we don't know how much they consume. And in order to do this risk assessment where we determine whether something may cause harm, we do need to know how much a week or how much a year is consumed so that we can say that this contaminant at this dose is being exposed to these people.
O'Hara says as they learn more about people's eating habits, toxicologists will be better able to take what they know about animal tissues and come up with risk assessments people can count on. If contamination is present but not hazardous, he says, there are very good reasons to eat what comes naturally. For example, fish and some marine mammals.
Some of the nutrients actually prevent diseases. The omega-3 fatty acids have been well documented as a source of nutrients that prevent heart disease in northern indigenous people. This has been well studied. And to eliminate this from the diet because of fear would be inappropriate, because then you may see a rise in heart disease because they would shift from their traditional foods to Western type foods, which have been associated with heart disease.
In the 90s, O'Hara says, there are fewer and fewer simple answers. Science isn't perfect, and although they're trying, scientists don't yet know everything they want to know about the food chain in the Arctic.
We want people to make educated decisions, and we want to help them with that. But one problem we have is admitting that sometimes we just don't know. And when we don't know, we want to tell them that and say that we're trying to find the answer.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, 2, 1. Borough Mayor Jim Sampson is a strong supporter of opening ANWR to oil exploration, but the current deal being pushed in Washington has given him and others reason to pause. Under the law that brought Alaska into the Union, the federal government agreed that the state was entitled to 90% of royalties gained from mineral development on federal land. Alaska's congressional delegation, the governor, and legislative leaders are now agreeing to drop that to 50%. That would violate the Statehood Act, necessitating it be changed, something that Sampson says should only be done with voter approval.
They talked about it on the floor of Congress. That was part of the deal. We voted on it. And I don't believe that it's right for Congress now to change that. And I don't think that the legislature should have the authority to unilaterally agree with that. I think that it should be a referendum vote of the people.
Sampson put the same question before the borough assembly last week and found unanimous agreement with his position.
It's sort of like when we were admitted to be the 49th state of the Union, we received as our entitlements 103.5 million acres of land. I mean, I feel just as strongly about that. I don't believe the Alaska legislature should be able to convene a special session and give away those entitlements. I don't think Congress can. A deal is a deal is a deal.
The agreement crossed philosophical lines and joined both conservative and more moderate members. Assemblyman Ladd McBride says the feds have racked up numerous violations of the Statehood Act, from fish and game management to land access. And while development is important, it shouldn't happen at the expense of another contract violation. Other members say lowering royalties would set a bad precedent in a state that has so many basic needs. Accepting less money would put lawmakers on a slippery slope toward giving away more. The Borough Assembly may be the first local government to go on record supporting a popular vote, but Fairbanks City Councilman John Immel says he's not so sure that others will follow. Standing on principle is one thing, he says, but opening ANWR is another.
We haven't really discussed it at all, and it was kind of a surprise to me that the borough did it so fast like that. I just don't see the federal government accepting 90-10. If we keep pushing that direction, I don't think we'll see ANWR at all.
Immel says since the feds are depending on ANWR revenues to balance the budget, lawmakers have fewer reasons to approve development under a 90-10 arrangement. 50-50, he says, is better than nothing. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
This notion of celebrating bounty around the time of the harvest has a long and rich history. The Canaanites brought in the vineyards, trod the grapes, and ate and drank in their houses of worship. The children of Israel copied the custom. They called it the Feast of the Tabernacles because they lived in tents during their festival, remembering the years when they had no homeland. The Hebrew celebration lasted an entire week. It is said they shared what they had with friends and family, other tribes and strangers, with the poor and orphans and the widows. In ancient Greece, Demeter was the founder of agriculture and the goddess of harvests. In tribute to her, each November, two wealthy and distinguished ladies prepared a great and sacred meal. The women of Athens, only the women and only the married women, gathered for 6 days of feasting and mirth and dance. In this new world, the first harvest was celebrated in 1621. The first winter had been a hard one. Out of 101 settlers, just 51 survived, dogged as they were by hunger, cold, and disease. The historians say also by terror. They were mostly tradesmen, not farmers, but with a good deal of help from their Wampanoag neighbors. When spring came, these tradesmen planted the untilled ground and tended it. They watched in awe through the summer as sprouts turned slowly, steadily to bounty. In November, they harvested, ground the wheat for bread, and hunted the forests and riverbanks for meat and fish. The 51, along with the 90 of the Indians who had helped and watched over them through the first year, all gathered together and celebrated. For 3 days, like generations before them in far places, they gave thanks for their harvest and for their survival. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3, 2, 1. Delta beef farmer Scott Miller is putting a new twist on an old theme. By reaching back and combining two past practices, he's been able to drastically cut the cost of keeping beef cattle over winter.
In the past, there just hasn't been very much growth in the red meat industry and in the beef industry in particular because of the high cost of wintering the beef cow. It just, by the time you fed her brome hay all winter, you lost money compared to what you could have sold that hay for.
Miller says most of the brome hay in Alaska is fed to horses, whose owners pay about $180 a ton. Miller still grows hay, but he sells it for cash. For the cows, he feeds a combination of oats and peas, which he can grow and store as silage for about $60 a ton. Delta Extension agent Don Korberg says Miller also cuts his cost further by letting the cows graze through the winter, rather than the usual practice of bringing all the feed to the cows.
What Scott has done is done some of that, but he's allowing the cow to go out and actually do the harvesting by just mowing it and putting in a swath or a windrow, and then lets her go out and graze during the day. And they'll do that. I've seen them out at 30, 35 below zero, and they don't have a real problem with that.
Korberg says it's a practice that many ranchers use in the mountain states of the West. He cautions, though, that Miller must watch out for the Delta bison herd, lest they learn that he's leaving food in the field. Fortunately for Miller, the bison are far away, and he says so far he's cut the cost of overwintering a cow from about $500 to less than $200. That enables him to sell finished animals at a lower price and compete with meat imported from Seattle.
Presently, we're producing 1% of our red meat, and that's just ridiculous. All the dollars that we are spending on food that is just leaving the state on a weekly basis, and that money could be staying in the state and having a lot of positive economic ramifications.
Miller's feeding some 250 head of cattle from part of his 1,000 acres and says there's room in Delta to raise 10 times that. He's sharing the information, he says, to get others involved so that together they can help support local slaughterhouses and other related facilities that keep Alaskan dollars in the state. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
There are 250 classified employees in the university system. They are the maintenance, custodial, and power plant workers, the plumbers and electricians. They're the folks who remove trash and snow and make sure the lights and heat and water all work at the urban and rural campuses around the state. Last February, their union negotiated an agreement with the university that established member wages, hours and benefits, and job site conditions. Both sides are living up to the contract in every way, with one exception. The university has not paid Classified Employee Association members the raises it agreed to. UAF maintenance mechanic Mike Mayberry is first vice president for the union's northern region.
The classified employees have a real problem trying to understand why the university cannot honor the deal that was made when we both mutually signed this contract. We're talking about approximately 0.2% of the university's FY95 operating budget, which equates to approximately 46 cents of a raise per employee.
Mayberry says CEA members are the only university employees who haven't gotten raises in the past 3 years.
The administrative people are getting their compensation plan funded this year. They've already got part of a raise October 1st, and after July 1 of next year, on their anniversary date, they'll start getting regular increments.
Mayberry says the association has gone public with its complaints because a private campaign to prod university regents to make good on the raises has gone nowhere. Recently, CEA filed suit. Bob Miller is the university's director for statewide public affairs. Miller says the problem is not with the university, but with the legislature's hold on the purse strings.
The university's position is that the money is not owed unless the legislature appropriates it. We requested the money and asked for it last year. It was not appropriated. We intend to ask for it again this next year. For me to go beyond that at this point to characterize the differences between the union and the university would be, I think, inappropriate in view of the fact that the papers filed in the grievance process will speak for themselves.
No court date on the dispute has yet been set. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3, 2, 1. Airport security was tightened in September after federal officials... 3, 2, 1. Airport security was tightened in September after federal officials noted an increased threat from international terrorists. For some visitors to the Fairbanks airport, that meant enduring vehicle inspections from a guard in the parking lot. Airport Safety Chief Chuck Grandy says security's now been reduced.
For the traveling public, the only thing that I would say is plan on an extra 5 minutes or so, because you're still going to get asked some questions as you check in at the counters, at the airline counters for your tickets and checking your bags in. As far as the airport is concerned, most of what we're doing at that time is more behind the scenes and instead of out front of the airport itself.
Grandy says the parking lot back gate has been reopened and the lot guard's been taken off duty, but vehicles are still subject to towing if they're parked too long in front of the terminal. The increased security was costing the airport about $9,000 a month, a minor sum when compared to the cost borne by other larger airports. The security level is still higher than it was in April, and while complaints increased as security tightened, Grandy says most visitors politely endured the extra measures.
This is not being done as an harassment or a invasion of someone's privacy. You know, our whole objective as far as security programs are concerned is for the safety of the traveling public itself and the protection of those resources that transport people in and out of Fairbanks and out of any international airport in the world.
But those justifications don't hold enough weight for one Fairbanks attorney. Kenneth Cavell says an airport security guard asked to search his truck one October day, and when he refused, he was told to park on the far side of the airport lot. Cavell argues the searches are a violation of constitutional protections.
The stops and searches made in these incidents are essentially blanket searches and stops, not based on any reasonable suspicion, and being made without any warrants or any probable cause to search under any exceptions to the warrant requirement.
Cavell complained to the governor and recently received a letter from Transportation Commissioner Joe Perkins, who apologizes for the intrusion but says the voluntary searches are legal and increased security is required by federal law. Cavell says he's none too happy about the intrusion and may file a Freedom of Information Act request to find out exactly why the increased security was necessary. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
3, 2, 1. Every fall, merchants use special sales and incentives to divert the flow of permanent fund money sent to Alaskans into their own business coffers. If payments were eventually capped at $700 per person, as a recent commission report suggested, some believe Alaskans would lose special opportunities, especially in the bush. John Sturm sells snow machines at Compos.
A lot of folks out there don't have a whole lot of credit at their disposal. In town, people can finance things fairly easily out there. A lot of times we'll get a whole family's dividends to get a new snow machine, which is real important to them out there. And where a lot of these people don't have any credit at all, that's their only avenue to make major purchases like that.
Sturm believes cutting government waste is the first step towards closing the budget gap. Other companies which have special offers for dividend dollars, like Alaska Airlines, say they have no idea if a cap would stop incentives. Spokesperson Luke Anselmi says the airline in the past has responded to other market pressures, including competition, in making its decision. He says they take on the issue year by year.
Obviously, we brought the program back this year when a lot of people thought it wasn't going to come back. And so I think that addresses whether or not we think it helps stimulate additional air transportation. We think it does, and to that extent, I think it's been a good deal for Alaskans, and it's been a good deal for us.
Kinselmi says the airline will wait for legislative action before they worry about a cap. Other market watchers say while the value of the dividend may be capped, Alaska's economy will still be swamped each fall with millions of discretionary dollars. And where there's money, merchants will find some way to attract it their way. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Fairbanks, 3, 2, 1. Suppose a museum has human remains that it wants to return to a village, but the people who live there believe it bad luck to speak about the dead, much less handle those remains. It's a problem that Miranda Wright says during a recent conference hit many Athabascan elders like a bomb.
Some of them were so hurt, they just couldn't talk. Yeah, I mean, all of these memories came flooding back. And through this process, so a lot of the beliefs that the Athabascan people hold started surfacing. A lot of things that we don't discuss. And death being one of the things. You don't talk about death, or especially individuals who have departed.
Wright is vice president of Keepers of the Treasure Alaska and has been dealing closely with repatriation. She says that traditionally when someone died, they would receive a ceremony that left their body exposed to the elements so that they may return to the land. But when museum collectors traveled north, they broke that cycle.
The practice of having things return to nature was interrupted when people started collecting human remains and grave goods and even cultural objects, because a lot of the masks and even ceremonial regalia, you know, naturally deteriorates and goes back to nature. I mean, it's part of the cycle of returning things to the land.
Wright says in addition to cultural hurdles, many Alaska villages lack the money to even stake claims for objects taken from them. In many places, public health and safety issues take precedence over repatriation claims.
The human resources are just not there in the rural communities, so the repatriation issue is always getting shoved off to the side for things that take priority, your day-to-day living issues.
Money, or the lack of it, has created hardships not just for the villages, but for the museums as well. Wright says some museums with large collections either don't have or won't spend the money necessary to return artifacts in a respectful way.
Institutions are saying, oh, we'll ship as far as Fairbanks, and then you have to pay from there. And all we can afford to ship in is a cardboard box. Well, do you want this? It will save money if we can put all the skulls in one box and all the long bones in another box, and then you can reassemble them when they get to your site. You know, and just the disrespect that's wrapped up in all of that, I think, is some of the things that's very painful to have to deal with.
But that's not to say the entire repatriation issue is stuck in a mire. Some organizations have received grants to help organize repatriation efforts. Vera Metcalf, the repatriation coordinator at the Bering Straits Foundation in Nome, says she expects to have a ceremony next summer to begin returning some 2,000 sets of remains to St. Lawrence Island. In the meantime, she's sorting through stacks of documents from some 140 museums. Remains from St. Lawrence Island make up one of the largest collections taken from Alaskans, and Metcalf says considering the task, the project is moving along well. And Miranda Wright says in spite of the hardship, the There are many positive sides to the process.
Now these things are surfacing, and people are realizing that their beliefs were very valid and were very important to the maintenance of their whole world. And these things are surfacing, and I now hear people saying things like, there are no superstitions. We had no superstitions. This was our belief. And we were shamed into thinking that what we had was wrong. But we're now realizing that what we had was correct for us. And so it's freeing people from that guilt that they carried for so long, and they are able to start talking about many of these beliefs that a lot of the young people have wanted to hear.
And as Alaska Native spirituality increases, so too does the knowledge of researchers. Mike Lewis, archaeology collections manager at the University of Alaska Museum, says the repatriation has given academics a chance to fill gaps in cultural understanding.
We've completed a knowledge of cultural practices that have given a lot more meaning even to the objects that are not subject to repatriation. And of course, those things that are subject to repatriation now has allowed us to provide the scientific information that we've developed over the years to the native groups in combination with their own cultural knowledge of it. So we've taken our two pots of knowledge now and combined them.
The University Museum recently met its deadline for notifying villages of its inventory. Lewis says the museum is prepared to transfer ownership of the articles, and villages may now reclaim objects or leave them with the museum for safekeeping. Returning ownership to native groups, he says, has changed the equation for researchers looking to learn about native history.
Some people are pretty upset about it and see it as a loss of knowledge, but actually, it's opening up new opportunities for the scientific community and anthropologists to work in closer association with native groups, because now it places the native groups in control of the research that goes on with those collections.
Lewis says the museum will now act as caretaker of the objects, allowing access to people only after they have permission from the owners of the artifacts. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Your name and...
3, 2, 1. In a place where winter lasts 6 months, people expect certain benefits. Among them is enough snow to play on. But as people complain about the lack of recreational opportunities, there are bigger effects, the consequences of which depend on one's perspective. Fish and game technician Roger Savoy says for trappers, poor trails mean missing a chance to harvest juvenile marten, many of which are likely to die because their prey, namely voles, will freeze without the usual insulating layer of snow.
Dispersing juveniles are likely to be in a little bit tougher shape and are likely to die anyway. This year might be a worse year for them, so that's an opportunity that trappers are going to miss out on by not being able to take advantage of these dispersing juveniles while they're around.
Savoy says the sparse snow cover also forced fish and game officials to postpone moose surveys because without a white background, the animals are hard to find from the air. Some business is off as well, namely snow plowing, but contractor Alice Ellingson says a long fall season kept employees busy into mid-October, so they're now doing maintenance that was put off by the long fall.
Talking to some of the contractors that are doing the snow removal, it doesn't seem to have hurt them so much because they were so busy this fall completing projects, road projects, building projects that they didn't anticipate finishing, that I think the late snow is not hurting as many people as we would anticipate.
Workers over at the State Department of Transportation are also busy fixing gear. Acting Station Foreman Mike Blanning says the department is saving on overtime pay, but wintertime road expenses aren't just going away.
We're seeing a lot more icing problems. For instance, up on the Elliott, roughly 26 to 28 miles, somewhere up in there, some of the places that normally behave themselves because of the insulating snow, we're finding that we're going to be up there quite a bit more this year just because of the icing.
So while drivers watch out for overflow, homeowners may also find new difficulties. Cooperative Extension Energy Specialist Rich Seifert says with the pending cold snap, inadequately constructed buildings may face problems other than just frozen pipes.
It's kind of a double jeopardy year in the interior here because we've not only had no snow after the freeze-up, but we also had fairly large amounts of rain and a wet autumn, which left some residual moisture in the top layers of the soil. That sets us up for soils which are vulnerable to frost heave.
Seifert says frost heaving can lift building foundations as much as 3 inches as the ground freezes deeper. Improperly installed water and sewer lines may also become troublesome, all at a time when many people are finding their favorite outdoor activities limited. Most snow machining has definitely been put on hold, and West Valley High School ski coach Mark Slaughter says those bent on exercising are missing the soft cushion snow provides.
Lathrop had one girl break an ankle, and we've had some other girls, you know, sprain their knees just in falls that normally wouldn't be that, you know, traumatic. And that's just because when they're landing, it's like landing on concrete now.
Physical therapists say the inactivity has generally reduced injuries, but Slaughter says a lot of people are breaking equipment and the rough trails are turning new skis into old beaters. And if that's not enough, the season's first dog race, the Two Rivers Tune-Up, has been canceled. So what's a person to do when faced with such adversity? Why, ask the Doctor of Optimism.
Every day it doesn't snow is a day closer to summer.
Former Governor Wally Hickel. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
For you.
Worldwide, 20 million men, women, and children are infected with HIV, and worldwide, over 4.5 million people have AIDS. Allison Ellis of the Interior AIDS Association says the surprise is, after 15 years of a growing epidemic, people still don't see the risk.
We know that youth feel like they're not at risk for it. There's this larger picture of crisis in after 10 years of trying to educate the public about this epidemic. We still see that there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstandings about HIV and about AIDS, about how it's transmitted, how it's contracted. We still see discrimination. There's still this feeling that it's not a community issue, even though it has touched almost everybody in our community in some form. It's still this is her problem or his problem or their problem and not an our problem.
With Alaska's small population, a relative few people here report they've contracted HIV, but people who are sexually active are nonetheless at risk. Ellis says perceptions about Alaska, its small population and distance from big cities outside, give people a false sense of security.
And that's where some of the feeling of, because I'm here in Fairbanks or I'm here in Alaska and I'm so far away from everything, I'm protected. But we know some other alarming statistics, like Alaska has the second highest rate of teenage pregnancy. So that tells us that there's at-risk behaviors that are going on, and there isn't a sense of it can happen to me.
The theme for this year's World AIDS Day is shared rights and shared responsibilities. Ellis says both are shared by individuals, the community, and the government.
Shared rights and shared responsibilities outlines that as individuals, we have the right to avoid being infected. And if we are infected, we have the right to receive support and care. As individuals, we have a responsibility to protect ourselves and others from infection. As families and communities, we have a responsibility to educate. That our government definitely has a responsibility to implement appropriate HIV prevention policies.
The Candlelight March tonight will be the 8th annual memorial for people who have died of AIDS and for their loved ones. The march begins at 5:45 this evening at Norwegian Library. A service of affirmation will be held just after the march at Fairbanks Lutheran Church. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. The scientists are all part of the 4-year-old Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Project. They've worked together since 1991 to study how contaminants from acid rain to radionuclides and heavy metals are affecting the plants and animals that live and eat and get eaten in the Arctic. Their first major report, about 1,000 pages long, is due out next summer. What they're working on now is how to get what they're learning across to those who need it most. RuralCap marine mammal biologist and planner Carl Hild says they're now figuring out how to get that information across to subsistence users.
There have been lengthy discussions about this issue of communicating the report to the general public. There have been recommendations that there be videos made, pamphlets, brochures. There's been talk about doing a whole series of radio programs, of having visiting scientists who would actually go out to the communities and sit down with the people and go through what was found for their region.
Hild says it's not as easy as saying an animal's polluted and shouldn't be eaten. Scientists are finding contaminants in plant and animal tissues, but preliminary data show that the benefits of a subsistence diet do outweigh the risks. Study has been from two directions. One is to see how contaminants flow through the ecosystem to look at the effect on the food chain. North Slope Borough toxicologist Todd O'Hara.
Then there's the human risk assessment or human aspect to it, which would be what is it people actually consume. So that's for hand to mouth. What is it that people consume in large quantities that may have some of these contaminants? And that's where you'd want to focus your attention. So you try to do both so that you understand how the contaminants are flowing through the system and how some of these may be getting to human consumers.
O'Hara says the connection between ecosystem and consumption is a major reason these Arctic scientists started working together.
There's very few correlations that can be made from other regions of the world to the Arctic because it is a very unique ecosystem.
The agreement started with Finnish scientists' concerns that pollution from Russia's Kola Peninsula was harming Finns, their air, land, and water. O'Hara says this willingness to discuss and work on issues that transcend national boundaries is a real breakthrough.
As a toxicologist, it is very exciting because people are now thinking in terms outside of political boundaries. These contaminants do not know political boundaries. And acid rain is a good example of where the United States was burning coal in the Midwest and it was affecting Canadian lakes. That's an example of transboundary effects. So it's nice that we've broken through that and we've gotten these countries together to look at contaminants in an entire ecosystem without boundaries, and that is the Arctic, or multiple ecosystems in the Arctic.
While scientists have equal commitment to the research, their member nations are not equally able to underwrite the work. Still, Hild says the nations are filling in gaps wherever they can.
Russia is very difficult. Russia's huge. It's got massive environmental problems, it has massive pollution, and it's got no money. Norway has been providing a lot of assistance in the collection of samples from the Kola Peninsula, as has Finland. They've been doing a lot of binational projects.
Besides Russia, Finland, and the United States, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, and Canada are all taking part in the international study and in meetings sponsored by the state of Alaska being held in Anchorage. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. When the Pentagon announced earlier this year that it was closing Fort Greely, Delta residents took action. They joined together, lobbied hard, and with help from Senator Ted Stevens, won a two-year reprieve. Ray Woodruff, director of the Delta Greely Community Coalition, says the grant money will help develop business and other plans to keep Delta alive once the post is mothballed.
We're going ahead because in 2 years, they may decide to move most or all of the people out, and at that point, we want to be ready to walk in and have an economic development plan and to have our economy to the point where we don't have to depend so much on federal dollars.
The coalition's been meeting for months, attempting to come up with a viable plan. They initially hosted meetings asking Deltans what they wanted in their town. With all the dreams on paper, coalition members set out to find out which goals were achievable.
There's quite a few ag-related things. There's quite a few tourism-related things. There are some educational-related things. And all of them seem to be stacking up very well. They won't any of them develop what we had from Fort Greeley, but that's probably a benefit in that we'll diversify our economy and not be so dependent on just one thing.
Coalition members face a big task as they attempt to replace some 400 jobs worth $20 million. Community and Regional Affairs Planner Ike Waits says this process is serving as something of a pilot project that may be applied in other places across the state.
Basically what's happening in Delta is a big chunk of government payroll is disappearing. And as we look across the state, we see similar things happening in a lot of the smaller communities that have been counting on government revenues.
Waite says the coalition is pursuing a second grant to combine with the first. Members will use part of the money to hire a consultant to put numbers behind the ideas. They hope to have a preliminary plan ready for bid by early spring. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Longer and stronger sentences introduced in 1980 and aggressive law enforcement have both set the pace for Alaska's prison population. Corrections Commissioner Margaret Pugh says the number of Alaskan inmates nearly doubled in the last decade, and she expects it to double again in the next 10 years.
In about 1985, in a like month, we had about 1,700 total inmates. 1995, 10 years later, we had about 3,000 inmates, and on a straight line projection in the year 2005, we'd have another 1,500 inmates.
But there's not necessarily enough space for them. Even now, Alaska's jails are so regularly overcrowded that the courts have intervened. If an institution houses more inmates than the court allows, the Department of Corrections gets fined. Commissioner Pugh says on any given day, 6 or 7 jails and the system as a whole tend to be over the top.
We have to date probably accrued about $750,000 worth of fines. None of the fines have been paid yet, in part because the legislature did not appropriate the money last year for the fines, lacking some guidance from the court in what that money would be used for.
Even under court-ordered capacities, if people break the law, get caught, and get sent to jail for longer and longer periods of time, and if no more jails are built to hold them, the corrections system will continue to bulge at the seams. Corrections Commissioner Margaret Pugh says only a few things can be done to relieve the growing pressure. Among them, she says, cut down on the number of people being jailed and increase the number of people being released.
And the department in the last year has begun to implement some programs that we think will help to do both number one and number two, decrease the inflow. We've got a day reporting pilot program in Anchorage to provide some intensive supervision to probationers and parolees, preventing reoffense and reducing the numbers that are violated to go back into incarceration.
And there are halfway houses, which relieve the stress on prisons without putting inmates on the street. The commissioner says a few more beds have also been added around the state this year, and more are expected in 1996.
And we may, in fact, have to add a lot more beds, but I think that Alaskans need to engage in conversations about what it costs. I saw on the news this morning the effects of the Three Strikes You're Out legislation in California, and then, of course, the article you referred to day before yesterday about numbers nationally. So before we engage in some huge building project, I'm not sure we can build our way out of this. In fact, I'm sure we can't build our way out of this. I think that all Alaskans need to be engaged in the conversations.
In the meantime, with about 3,000 prison inmates out of 600,000 residents, about one in every 200 Alaskans is in jail. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3, 2, 1. Police say hotel staff discovered the body of UAF Professor Keith Runcorn late Tuesday morning. Police Lieutenant Glenn Breitenstein says the autopsy report is due this evening, but it looks like Runcorn was strangled. He says robbery may have been a motive.
It's too soon to tell whether robbery was the motive. However, the room did appear to have been ransacked slightly, and we are still trying to determine if anything is missing. We know that the victim was seen at a local eating establishment late the prior evening. We do not know what took place from the time he was last seen at the eating establishment until his death.
Police have no suspects and are still sifting physical evidence for clues, but they say the downtown hotel where Runcorn was staying wasn't in the high crime area, and police concede it's unusual for burglars to kill. The 76-year-old Runcorn earned worldwide recognition for his pioneering work on plate tectonics. He began teaching at UAF in 1989 as the Sidney Chapman Professor of Natural Sciences, a prestigious chair at the university. But colleagues like Professor Rudy Krejci say Runcorn dismissed the pomp and circumstance.
That is why when he was well known, you know, and regarded as man who missed Nobel Prize, you know, just by a hair, you know. He never bragged about being, you know, Chapman's professor of physics here, you know. He was a very modest man.
Runcorn expressed this modesty in an interview last week. He was preparing a public lecture on the discovery of the X-ray and the first radio transmission. Both events took place a century ago, And Runcorn said that despite the amazing advances made since then, science remained a journey into the unknown.
All the discoverers of physics have a mystery attached to them. And even if you go back, you see, to Newton's discovery of gravitation. What is gravitation? It's still a very mysterious force.
Runcorn was praised by colleagues for his breadth of mind. He ranged across the disciplines, says Paul Reichart, the Dean of Natural Sciences at UAF.
In fact, one of the projects that he was working on was a conference that really is under the auspices of the Vatican on the origins of life. And you know, Keith and some of his buddies were bringing together scientists and theologians in an attempt to have a really serious discussion about that issue that nobody has really good answers for.
Runcorn was unmarried and is survived by a mother and sister in England. University officials say Runcorn was visiting friends in San Diego and preparing for a conference on geophysics later this week. Since many of his colleagues will be at that conference, UAF will likely delay any memorial service until December 18th. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
3, 2, 1. For most people, bicycling is purely a summertime activity. Come fall, the bikes are put away and the skis come out. But like so many other pursuits, some diehards have adapted bicycling to the cold. The sport of winter biking has largely been pioneered in Alaska, and according to Simon Rackauer, owner of All Weather Sports, the fun is spreading.
We just get increasing numbers of calls. There's explosive growth. There's this little sport that's growing up all over the country and in some parts of the rest of the world.
Until recently, winter biking was largely the domain of commuters trying to combine exercise with low-budget transportation. But it's moving off-road, and winter trail users are more likely than ever to see bike tracks weaving between ski prints. That's due in part to Rackauer's creation of double-wide rims, which allow bikes more flotation on softer trails. Rackauer created initial designs by welding two rims together, but as interest increased, he contracted with a Chicago factory to make raw rims which are sent to Fairbanks for finishing. The rims have caught on with downhill bike racers, those people who spend summers careening down mountainsides, and where Rackauer initially figured he'd sell only 100, this year he'll sell 1,000 at $60 a piece.
I think of it as you're thrashing around in the water, and you thrash around enough and the sharks come. In this case, I want the sharks to come. We've been thrashing around about winter bikes for quite a few years now, and the sharks are smelling us.
Rackauer has succeeded by combining his talents in design with filling a niche market. The money isn't necessarily big, but he's positioned on the ground level of a growing market.
It really keeps things going in the winter. It allows us to sell other things besides the stuff we make. Because of the rims, we're known well throughout the country and to some extent throughout the world as winter cycling experts. Anybody that wants the rims or wants to know about I Did a Bike, no matter where they are, and it's very easy to get in touch now with computers and faxes and all, they get in touch with us.
In addition to selling rims, Rackauer offers complimentary gear like studded tires and cold weather greases. While winter use prompted development of the rims, most of his sales now go to the downhill racers and are being tested for 1950s-style beach cruisers. But those market developments may eventually lead to the undoing of Rackauer's dominance of the wide rim market.
What happens is if there's something that we see a need for that's not being made, we'll make it. And if it's a good idea, sooner or later, a big company will make it too, and usually at that point we get out of the field.
Rackauer hopes the rims will help him develop relationships with manufacturers that lead him further into the design business. Connecticut bike shop owner Jeff Yonke says he's seen winter biking catching on back east, and Rackauer has played a significant role in that.
The information and the products which he's been able to put together have done a lot to, create a new type of sport or a new winter sport or provide people with another aspect of cycling.
Yonke says spotty snowfall on the East Coast has kept recreational biking at a minimum this year, but if the snow falls thick like it did 2 years ago, he now knows where to turn for advice. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Terry Austin says she and Janelle McCracken dreamed about what they might do if only they had the chance.
I think every teacher sort of talks about that. You know, what if I ran my school, this is how we would do it.
Austin and McCracken are fourth grade teachers, job sharing a position at Nordale School. Their vision is Chinook Charter Elementary. Right now it's a project on paper, but McCracken and Austin hope to begin teaching 50 or 60 elementary students as early as next fall. She says they're designing a small learning community, a family team, emphasizing both individual learning opportunities and personal responsibility.
It means that the students, say, in the fourth through sixth grade would be working together. We, in turn, will go and work with the younger students, the K through three students, where we will teach and we will work. And those younger students will learn from us, and we will learn from them.
The founders envision a school day divided in two parts: the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic, taught in the morning, and what they're calling a learning lab in the afternoon. She offers the example of a botany lesson in the learning lab,
which is very much a hands-on project type of approach, where students would be growing the plants, reading about the plants, using the CD-ROMs on the computer about the plants, and working with people in the community who know about plants.
Helping hands seem a vital element of the charter school concept. Organizers are building not just classes, but curricula, budgets, staff, administrative policies, and more from the ground up. At Chinook, they're hoping to attract a strong, active advisory board.
Because you run everything. You do the building, you do the cleaning, you do all of the finances, you do it all, everything that is now done in public school. And we think that parents will give us a hand, hopefully some community members who also share the possibilities of school will give us a hand.
Before they can open their doors, organizers must present a detailed proposal to the district and win approval and funding from the school board. School board president Sue Wilkin says she feels the board is supportive of the charter concept, and if organizers do their homework, it will be there to help these new schools get going.
Sometimes, because we've always done things one way, doesn't mean that it's always the best way, that we need to be looking for new ways and new possibilities of helping to educate the kids. I think kids are different, they change, their learning styles change, their families are changing, what parents are doing are changing, so we just can't be stagnant in what we offer for kids.
Wilkin does admit to some personal hesitation about charter schools. She says in raising four children, she's often felt that some alternative idea might be better than the programs the district offers. But she's also felt that if she and other parents put their energies into making those programs better, everyone would have better schools.
But at the same time, I think by telling people that they can't do things like that, setting up charter schools or alternative situations, basically what you end up with are people that not only are disillusioned by what is happening in the regular program, but they just throw their hands up because we're not open to any kind of new ideas.
Terry Austin says to her, the potential in Chinook Charter Elementary is to be able to tailor teaching to what students need.
Right now, public schools across the nation are the general size sock that fits every foot. They're trying to be everything to everybody, and I think that's a very difficult role. I know it is for me as a classroom teacher.
She hopes charter schools and Chinook, if it gets the opportunity, will be able to offer innovation and education to their students and maybe some new ideas to the district. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.